Okay, well, hi everybody. We're now officially starting, even though we kind of already started. But that's okay. Thank you for attending the pre-show. So we're here with Jonathan Mayberry.
Hola. Hi. I don't know how many of you guys are here because you tripped over me in DragonCon here or got bad directions or think this is another panel. But hey, you're here, so hi. Let me give you a brief idea of who I am, what I write. For about 25 years of my career, I was a magazine guy, writing martial arts articles and articles about everything from I would write articles on how to gift wrap, whatever. Any article I could come up with, I would write. So I was an all-purpose magazine guy. I wrote plays. I wrote greeting cards. I don't know if you ever saw those sarcastic cards, mean little old lady cards. I wrote a bunch of those early on. I wrote instructions on how to plant seeds, poke hole in ground, drop in seed. Got paid $5,000 to write that, So I've done a lot of weird stuff over my career, and it's kind of prepared me for the career I have now in that I'm writing a lot of different sorts of things all at once. I got into writing horror and science fiction and thrillers and all that whole thing in 2005. Up to that point, I've been writing textbooks and mainstream books on martial arts and that sort of thing. And then I wrote a book of vampire folklore, written under a pen name of Shane MacDougall, the only book I've ever written under a pen name and the only book I ever will write under a pen name, which was vampire folklore. Every vampire legends are different all over the world. Every country has vampire legends, and most of what people know about vampires comes from Hollywood or Bram Stoker. And I grew up with a spooky old grandmother who taught me about the folklore of Europe and so on, and it's substantially different. Like, there are no vampire legends in Transylvania at all. There are lots of ghost legends, and those ghosts take all different forms, the Strigoi, but there are no actual vampire legends from that country. There are no vampire legends in which sunlight kills a vampire. That was invented in the movie Nosferatu, 1922, because they were over budget, over time, and one of the few people who had not bailed from the crew was the lighting director. And they couldn't film the ending that was scripted because it was a big fight with gypsies in a courtyard because they were pirating Dracula. So the lighting guy said, you know what? We've always put him in the shadows, creature of darkness, that's the motif. Why not have sunlight kill him? Because that's pure, and we'll just do that. And the director's like, yeah, sure, we got to get this thing done today. And suddenly sunlight kills vampires. The stake, not really used to kill vampires. Holy objects not used to drive them away. Inviting a vampire in is the only way to get them in. Just the opposite in a lot of folklore. So I wanted to put a lot of stuff out there. So I started with that, and I was the vampire guy for a while, which was fun. But one of the things that frustrated me was I wasn't finding any fiction that tapped folklore. All the vampire fiction I read, including a lot of stuff that I love, is basically the Hollywood vampire over and over again, or the Bram Stoker vampire. So I wrote Ghost Road Blues. And that was my attempt to get it out of my system, to write a book that in which people were up against folkloric vampires. And what happened is I actually liked writing fiction, which I didn't know I was going to do because I hadn't really done much of that. I sold the book. I got an agent very quickly, and I sold the book very quickly as the opening of a trilogy. And the book went on to win the Bram Stoker Award for Best First Novel and was up for Novel of the Year, and it was up against Stephen King for Novel of the Year. Guess who won? Two votes, though. Two vote difference. I'll take that to my grave.
What was it called again?
Ghost Road Blues.
Ghost Road?
Yeah, and it's the first of a trilogy. The second book, Dead Man's Song, and the third is Bad Moon Rising. Actually, I have my book list in the back of my business cards. If anyone wants it, it has lists of all my books and comics and so on.
Which King novel beat you?
Lissy's Story, which was his most critically acclaimed novel, so I'm okay with that. I might have had some issues being beaten by something like The Cell, which I didn't like quite as much, but Lissy's Story is a damn good book, so, and I actually got to meet King shortly after that. He's very gracious and a very funny guy. So from that point on, I'm writing horror. I write a lot of nonfiction books. Zombie CSU is so far my biggest international bestseller zombie book. But I've also written a number of books on vampire and supernatural folklore, including my newest one, Wanted Undead or Alive, which deals with vampire folklore, actually deals with the fight against good against evil, going back to biblical times and various religious viewpoints, historical, cultural, artistic, literary. Then we, you know, as we move forward following that, we get into good and evil in comics. And we also have a big thing about conventions and cosplay in there, because some people choose to wear superhero costumes and some people choose supervillain or monster costumes. So I interviewed a lot of cosplayers to ask why. Leanna Kay, Ruby Rocket, Dave Ross, you know, a bunch of people who were actually here that I met at Dragon Con were interviewed for the book, and they had photos in there. We also interviewed Stan Lee, John Carpenter, Jack Ketchum, Charlene Harris, Sherilyn Kenyon, and just like everybody who's in the horror field or fantasy field. And it's a fascinating book. It came out 2 weeks ago, and I think there's like one or two copies left at Larry Smith Booksellers downstairs. Or yeah, it is downstairs, yeah. But it's also at every bookstore. And it's Wanted, Undead or Alive, Vampire Hunters and Other Kick-Ass Enemies of Evil. It's co-written by Janice Gable Bashman, and yeah, I had a blast writing the book. It's so much fun. But now I'm writing fiction. And most of my fiction tends to involve darker elements. You know, the Ghost Road Blues trilogy is done, or the Pine Deep trilogy, as it's called, is done. The second Joe Ledger novel, Dragon Factory, is out. The third, King of Plagues, will be out in March. And I'll be starting to work on the fourth, The Others, which deals with genetically engineered vampire assassins. It's actually going to be based on hard science, too. So I'm going to have fun with that. But it ties into, for those of you who know anything about vampire folklore, to first of all, it ties into the Inquisition and the legends of the Stregoni Benefici. Anybody ever heard of Stregoni Benefici? Couple? What they are vampires who were, according to church records, existing church records, were vampires who were captured by monks and converted back to belief in God, meaning they were tortured as the Inquisition. That's their hobby, you know, they were good at it. And they became vampire hitmen for the church. And this is actually in church records, which I think is extremely cool. And also the Benedanti, who were werewolves in Italy and Germany, who would go into the spirit world at night and fight monsters. And several of them were put on trial by the Inquisition because they, you know, they were monsters. And this one celebrated case, this guy named Tice, his court the court records of his case are still archived. You can get them in some of the bigger museums, bigger libraries. They tortured this guy to try to get him to say that he served Satan. And he said, no, I'm like the 90th generation. We go back to the Etruscans. We've always been on God's side. And you know, right, you know, he said, I'm a Catholic. I'm fighting for heaven. They eventually let him go. Now, the Inquisition is a real short list of people. The Inquisition let go, who also confessed to be monsters. And Benedanti means good walkers, but the Inquisition gave him a nickname, the Hound of God. And all the Benedanti from that point forward were known as the Hounds of God. So those both play into my story, because there's a religious, super right Catholic group and a super right Muslim group using different supernatural, or supposedly supernatural beings, as assassins in a new type of Cold War. And that's the fourth Joe Ledger novel.
So Catholic vampires attacking the Muslim vampires?
Catholic vampires attacking the Muslim werewolves. The Muslims got a hold of the genetic line, because it's genetics in the story. Right. They got a hold of the, they raided the tombs of Tice and his family to get, to reclaim the DNA to be able to create werewolves. So Joe's caught in the middle of like, hey, wait a minute, I'm actually fighting vampires and werewolves, sort of thing. I'm going to have a lot of fun with that book. And it also deals with an Arawak Indian bat cult in Aruba, which I discovered when my wife and I were in Aruba. And we're in Aruba, and you know, I partly own business because I was writing a book and found there's a bat cult from Aruba.
Does that mean the entire trip was decorative?
Yes, it was. Because I worked every day.
And it gives you the opportunity to say a cool phrase like bat cult from Aruba.
I'm telling you. You know, bat cult, I just said bat cult in Aruba. 4,000-year-old bat cult. You know, how cool. I didn't know that when I got there. I knew they had Arawak Indians and, you know, so on. Bat cult. I went to an archaeology museum. It was, honestly, I had like a ray of light hitting me in the face and music when I saw that in the face.
I also like the idea of the, it almost sounds like you're doing the Creature Commandos of the Vatican there.
In a way. Not a bad nickname. Somebody in the book has to use that kind of pop culture reference. But yeah, I'm having fun with it. So I'll be doing that next. But Dead of Night is up is what I'm writing right now. But and also I wound up getting involved in comic books. Marvel Zombies Return was one I was on a team. For those who know who Seth Graham Smith is from Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, he and I and David Wellington, who did Monster Island, Monster Planet, and Fred Van Lent, we were the writing team for Marvel Zombies Return, and it was a big hit in comic book form. It was a New York Times bestseller. 7 weeks. In hardback form, it's about to come out in paperback, and we'll probably be a New York Times bestseller again, and we're all real happy with that. You know, it's a nice place to be. And there is actually a New York Times list for comic books in hardback and paperback. You know, they have separate lists for this.
Well, I was curious, what, because I know you are more heavily into comic books than the writing, because doing monthly books and such, since last time that we were here. What?
Yeah.
Was there any kind of learning curve or transitional thing that you had to do from going into, because you talked about going from articles and nonfiction into fiction, but now you're into scripting comics. Was that just another transition for you, or did you have to pick it up?
How many of you are writers in the group? There's actually quite a few. It's an interesting thing with learning how to do different types of writing. Since I've done a lot of different types over the years, I've actually come up with a pretty good system for it. I look at something and I deconstruct it. So before I even got a sample of a comic book, I went to, there was a Borders near me that had a comic rack. Got a couple comics, and I just would open the comic and I would write the script based on the actual finished product to try to retro-engineer what the script would have looked like. And I did that for a couple of comics to get a feel of how the script would be. Shortly after that, when Marvel, this is actually before Marvel called me, I was doing it because we were going to pitch to Marvel, which was kind of funny. We never had to. When Marvel contacted me and asked me if I'd like to write for comics, silly question. I got a couple of scripts from them, and it's really similar. So a lot of the trick to learning how a style of writing is deconstruction. If you wanted to write, say, a paranormal romance or paranormal fantasy or urban fantasy, read the book first as a reader, and then go through and outline it as a writer. You just create the outline from the book as you're reading it. Look for where the three acts are. Look for the scenes. Look for how many action scenes. You'll see, by the time you're done, you'll have a formula for a successful novel, because that novel's in print. So you'll have that formula for how that novel was written. It's something I teach my writing students, and it works really well. It's deconstruction. Now, the real learning curve for me, though, is, I don't write thin books. I 400 plus pages, even my young adult novel, this is my first young adult novel, is 400 and almost 60 pages. So I don't write short stuff. And comics are, it's a 22-page comic. So you have to learn to change your view of how stories are told from all words to relying a lot on the art. And you have to tell the artist what visuals you want so that the artist can drive the story visually. Sometimes you take a single panel that can convey what would be a chapter in a story. A good example is, I don't know if anybody's reading Marvel Universe versus Punisher, but there are a couple of panels in here that is one paragraph of description for me to write it, but then the artist takes that panel and just goes crazy with it, does something with it that just makes it blossom out. And a good example of, like, I can't see it from here, but there's two pages here where Punisher's fighting an infected wolf, infected Deadpool, and then chopping him up and burying his body parts all over New York. Now, two things about this. One, I had to, like, there's a scene where the Punisher's just leaning his gun over his shoulder and firing backwards because he knows the guy, he knows Deadpool's behind him. To describe exactly what I wanted in terms of mood and so on, would have, in a script, it's about this big. But then the artist gets it, and the artist thinks of, thinks cinematically. They think of angle. The artist is very much like a cinematographer. He looks at how that visual will, what mood, what part of that. Like, I'm just saying firing a gun. He can choose single shots. He can choose different angles on the gun, different angle on him, the expression on the shooter's face. All of those things are part of the artist's storytelling. So you have to trust that they really will bring, you know, a great degree of artistry to it, a great degree of storytelling ability to it. Sometimes you get, you know, your pencils back from the artist, and they're not quite right, and you have to suggest something else. But what I found is a lot of these guys, and you know, Marvel works with some really, really great guys. They're so used to be able to drive a story that you can use fewer and fewer words as they appear in the comic. The script may actually be longer because you're describing what you want. You can even describe the emotional content you want, and then it's up to the artist to put that in there. And the artists do a great degree of the work there. And also, then you see what an inker. Well, in this case, Goran Farlov does art, the pencils and inks, but then we have the colorist who comes in, and Lee Loffridge, who did the coloring for this book, just made it beautiful. I mean, it literally is cinematically beautiful. And you know, the first issue sold out, and, you know, bam. The second issue is probably sold out by now, and the third issue just came out, so that's probably going to get close to it. I've been told that it's just selling really, really, really well, and you know, I can't take all the credit of that from having written it. I mean, it's a team effort, and everyone brought their A game. So you know, and the backtrack on this helps. It's helping me with my novels because it's helping me get to the visual in a scene quicker. Because I you know, I'm now thinking more visually. I'm actually, you know, imagining it as visually as I'm writing it. So it's actually helping my novels. It's giving me a different slant on my novels, and they may actually get shorter.
Does it help you at all to think of, for example, you know, you're saying the 22 pages versus the 450 or so of these as chapters in a longer story? Like if you were, you know, writing monthly versus this, which is a limited series. I mean, does that help you at all? Or
It's still plotted like a novel. You know, most series comics are between, even an ongoing series like Spider-Man would be told in six-issue arcs because they want to collect those into a, you know, hardback or trade paperback. They want a story within the overall series. But a limited series, you know, this one is four issues. I have a Captain America one starting in January called Hail Hydra. That's five issues. I had Doom War, which was six issues. You plot it like a novel, and you plot it in three acts. But even then, within each individual comic, there's three acts. And each one has to have a twist moment that pivots the story. So, and you don't necessarily do that as much in a novel. You do the three-act structure, but you don't necessarily have the three acts within each individual act. So it's slightly different. And again, that's informing my writing because I'm starting to put twists within the individual acts of my novels because I'm doing it with the individual comics.
Mm.
And I think it's amping up the tension and it speeds up the pace of novels. King of Plagues was the first novel I wrote since I started writing comics. And it's a fast-paced story. A lot of stuff's happening.
Going back to, because I know you've got a lot of different projects going at one time, how do you, whether it's outside of your head or inside your head, work all of that so that you can, I guess, keep all of those plates spinning at one time?
Yeah, time.
What's your secret?
Yeah. Well, first off, time management is a real, real important thing. And you know, it's my day job, so I can devote my whole workday to it. But when I was a kid, I met Ray Bradbury. And one of the things he told me was that writing is 99% thinking about it, and the rest is typing. And that's often true, because, I mean, no matter where I am, whether I'm walking down the street, trying to get through the traffic here in my little buggy, sitting at the doctor's office waiting for, you know, for that. Anywhere I am, shower, pool, I'm thinking about story. And for most writers, you know, we have our characters start talking to each other in their head, not to us. They're talking to each other. They're having a conversation, but the scene is happening. And if you're not a writer, this is a serious cry for help.
Sometimes when you are a writer, yeah, it's a serious cry for help.
Because, you know, who the hell are those folks? You know, and one of the weird things about it is you don't know which ones are going to start. Like, you know, I've got a Captain America story, a script that I have to get delivered tomorrow. So, you know, I'm really into that story. But now that I'm actually writing the script, the characters from my novel dead of night are starting to have conversations. A tense moment is coming. And one of the things you have to do is you have to occasionally stop and get that on paper so that they'll shut the hell up long enough for you to write this. So, you know, I make a few notes on Dead of Night so I can get back to writing Captain America. And it helps if you don't acknowledge them and let their voice be heard and record, even if it's just a couple of notes, they'll keep chattering. And if you think you're going to remember it, if you don't write it down, no, you will not. I lost some good stuff by thinking, I'll remember that in the morning, I'll remember that tomorrow. Nope. I even got to the point where we bought a scuba diver's board so I could have that by the shower.
Nice. Well, that's the, when you talk about the voices in your head and so forth, and so you're basically just time management and placating those voices is the key.
Yeah, and lots of outlines. I outline everything.
And it actually reminds me of the story about James Thurber. Said his wife came up to him at a party one time and just leaned over and said, "Damn it, Thurber, stop writing." And he's standing in the middle of the room. So, now, going back to something that you said about the hard science that's involved, I know that that's one of your big things. I mean, because coming from a nonfiction background for that, I take it there is some joy and curiosity that goes into digging for these things, whether they're bat cults or not.
Yeah, I've been saying for years that I'm a knowledge junkie. I definitely am. I'm not looking for a cure, just a fix. I love new information, and you know, I'm a bit of a science geek. And I'm not a trained scientist, but I have a love of science, and I've been reading about science my whole life. And I also like finding out. I'm very political, so I look at the clash between science and politics. Which becomes quite an issue because a lot of science is then used by military, by corporations, and so on. So I like finding new information, and I like finding stuff that nobody else yet has heard about. And one of the ways I do it is something I learned when being trained to be a journalist. I don't like quoting existing sources. I never did. I like finding out who is being quoted in an existing source, a recent article, and then going finding that person. So if I read an article on transgenic science in Newsweek, the latest issue of Newsweek, and they say that, you know, somebody from Johns Hopkins is being interviewed, I'm going to go to the Johns Hopkins webpage, go to the staff page, and find that person and interview that person via email. That gets me the most recent information. And what happens is, no matter how quickly it gets into print in a news article, it's already out of date. So I want the new stuff, and I ask these guys, you know, what. Also, I don't assume that I know enough about the subject to be able to ask the right questions, because you know, when you're an amateur and have interest in something, you know a great deal about something, but these guys are working at it; it's their field. So I'll ask one of the questions I often ask is, "What should I have asked you that I didn't?" You know, given that the topic we're talking about, or what's the coolest or most interesting thing you know in your field that you tell everyone, but you haven't yet talked about an article. And sometimes it's some weird aspect of science that doesn't make the regular press. A good example, when I was researching Dragon Factory, there was a geneticist I was working with who was looking for transgenic stuff to give mercenaries ape strength, some DNA from ape to give them greater musculature. That was one of my themes. And I said, well, what other things are going on in transgenics? And he said, did you hear about the goats? And I said, what goats? He said, there's farms of goats in Canada where they've given them the gene from the orb weaver spider to produce spider silk. And I'm thinking, spider goat. Actually, they don't look like spiders. The silk is produced in their milk, but it's in great quantities. And it's being used in everything from Kevlar vests to space science, because it's incredibly durable. It's hard. It's stronger than steel, and goats are producing it. And I thought that was creepy in the coolest possible way. So I had to find out about that. And then another. I was talking to a guy about hibernation science for patient zero, because that could explain one of the qualities of a zombie if the metabolism was partly reduced. And he said, yeah, you know, there's a a lab where they're killing dogs and bringing them back 12 hours later because it's part of research to save guys who have been hurt in combat. The idea is if they're you know, seriously injured, they exsanguinate them, essentially kill them, flash freeze them, fly them to a really high-tech lab, resanguinate them, bring them back, and do the surgery. That's the plan. And so they've been killing these dogs to practice and successfully bringing them back. And the lab is in Pittsburgh. Now, if you're not a zombie fan, you weren't laughing just now. Of all the places they're playing with bringing things back from the dead, Pittsburgh. You know? So I had to include that in. I included that sidebar on that zombie CSU because that's a little thing that one of the scientists told me. Says you're going to love this, and every once in a while they'll send me an email with something that's, you know, really cool. Oh, you'll love this. One of the weird side effects, though, and this is something we were talking about one of the panels recently, is that sometimes you get some information and you put it into a story, and a few months later that's the headline of the news. Writers. We, you know, the one of the reasons they call it speculative fiction is because we are wondering what could happen next. And it's usually not what's the best case scenario. You know, we want what's the worst case scenario. You know, how can somebody take this and screw around with it? And a lot of it is, it was very clearly defined by a line from Jurassic Park. We spend so much time wondering if we can, we don't stop to consider whether we should. And that phrase defines much of what I write. Neanderthals are a good example. I was in Dragon Factory. There's a subplot where a modern Nazi group is creating Neanderthals as a slave race. They're cloning them from DNA. And I thought, wow, this would be something that, you know, somebody with the resources and the lack of morals would definitely do. The day Dragon Factory came out, it was either National Geo or Archaeology Magazine came out with a cover story on how scientists are getting ready to clone Neanderthals. It isn't a matter of if we will be able to do it. The debate is only when, and whether they should do more than one. Because if they do more than one, the Neanderthal won't be alone. So they should do a bunch of them. Now, there are so many bioethical debates just built right into that. These scientists are jazzed about doing this. And it came out right at the time I have it where people are using that to create a slave race. And some of the same scientists involved were guys I interviewed.
So, one last question for me, and then we'll throw it open, and then maybe we'll ask you to give us some words. I was just wondering, so, like you said, articles to nonfiction, to fiction, and to comics, what other medium do you plan on trying to conquer next?
Well, I had a tentative reach out from a game company, and can't give any details because right as we left, we got a reach out from a major game company asking if I'd be interested in possibly writing games. And I'm interested conditionally. You know, everything's got to work into my schedule because right now I'm writing three books, you know, I'm writing a novel every 3 to 4 months, and I'm writing a comic book every other week. So I'm writing short stories. So I'm moderately busy, and I do like to see my wife. But the game thing sounds really cool. You know, I haven't done a lot of gaming myself, but I've read enough about it, and I know some guys who write in it. I know a lot of people who play games, and I was fascinated and surprised to learn how much writing goes into a game, even a video game. There, all those stories, all the different levels, all the different possible directions, somebody wrote those. So writers are getting, I mean, that's a whole field of writing that's there. And, you know, I love the Resident Evil movies. Even though they're not, I know, the same as the game, I think they're among the most fun of the zombie films. And I know people who play the Resident Evil games, and they love them, absolutely love those games. And the books and you know, at con, you see tons of people in Umbrella Corporation stuff. You know, that's a whole world. That's just one game. And, you know, all these games out there. And so I might look into that. And screenwriting for TV is not outside the realm of possibility if Department Zero becomes a show. which is there's a possibility of that. And it would be called Department Zero, not Patient Zero, by the way.
Okay, we'll throw it out to questions for a little bit here. Does anyone have anything? Otherwise, we'll just keep going on. Yes?
It's a stupid question. Where do you come out on slow versus fast zombies?
Ah, love slow zombies in fiction. Love fast zombies in movies.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with either in almost any story if the response to them is appropriately intelligent. My take on it is, you know, since I fell in love with zombie movies from the original Night of the Living Dead, I was there when it premiered in Philly, and I've been doing martial arts my whole life, so I'm not afraid of slow zombies. You know, if there was a whole bunch of slow zombies in here, I got enough weapons here, even with a bad leg, I'm getting my wife and myself out of the room. Not sure about the rest of you, but I'll give you advice and maybe lead the team, but some of you may have to be fed to the zombies to get us out. So, but I will get out of this room. Fast zombies, if a whole bunch of you were fast zombies, I'm probably the lunch buffet. Because that ultimately becomes a no-win situation in something that spreads fast. That's why I think they're scarier in movies. My favorite zombie film of all time is the unrated director's cut of Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead. And yes, I do like the original, and I like a lot of other zombie films. That one is, to me, is a perfect zombie film. I've watched it at least 50 to 100 times. It's perfectly watchable. I'm probably going to become addicted to The Walking Dead, however, even though they're slow zombies, because it looks like they're doing it right. They're doing it the way the comic was written, and I'm absolutely delighted about that. I'm Halloween night, that's where I'm going to be.
Yeah.
Watching the show.
Who else? Yes.
Yeah, back to your comic writing.
I'm over here.
Been a comic collector and reader for about 30 years, and you know, over the years, comics, you know, less densely scripted, as you were talking about. Okay, was there a mandate by the editors at Marvel when you started writing them? Did it have to be paced a certain way just so it, because I know the big thing, Marvel's been criticized over the years about pacing stories purposely, just to be able to be packaged.
Not really.
You know, into a compact story to be sold in regular bookstores, you know, that sort of thing.
The only pacing thing I've gotten is that, you know, if I pitch something that they don't think will fit into six issues, they want another pitch. That's all. So it really never gets past the pitch point if they don't think the story will stretch. Conversely, if I'm pitching something, you know, for four issues, and they say, wow, this is way too much story for four issues, can you pull out a thread or two? That actually is kind of how Marvel Universe versus the Punisher got started, because I pitched something called Marvel Infected, which would have been one of the cross-continuity books where other writers would be writing different chapters of it as, you know, as a big Marvel event. And it almost went. But they read my first script, and they wanted me to write a different version of it, take it out of continuity, and write a different version that was, you know, bleaker and more dangerous, which is fine with me. And they gave me a totally free hand to do whatever I wanted with the comic, except for the last page. My editor and I had a debate about the last page, and that's one area where I did yield to the change, because they're so enthusiastic about it, they want the option of more stories set in that world. And my last page of the original thing would have prevented that. Someday I will get to write that story, which is most of the story with that alternate ending, but we are in discussions now for both sequels and prequels.
Of course they got to leave the option for sequels.
Yeah, but you know, if we just change it one page, it leaves a lot of options, and they're good, fun stories that I would like to tell, but they're asking me to determine what those stories would be. They're not, you know, they'll say, can you, you know, pitch what you would like to write next? And I pitched one, and I can't mention what it would be, and they jumped on it. So I'm hoping we get started on that one soon.
Okay. I think, yes, right here.
Just your top three zombie novels and top three zombie/horror movies.
Top three zombie novels. My favorite zombie novel is one that not enough people have read. The original Return of the Living Dead by John Russo. It was done before Dawn of the Dead came out. It was done. It had nothing to do with the movie of the same title. But John Russo wrote a book called Return of the Living Dead, which picks up right where Night of the Living Dead ends. And John Russo was, he co-wrote Night of the Living Dead with George Romero. So I love that book. It's a real thin paperback, very hard to find. Great book. My second favorite zombie book is actually an anthology. I love this one, New Dead. And, but it seems unfair for me to pimp that one too much as my favorite of all time. But the gold standard for zombie anthologies was, Book of the Dead, John Skip, Craig Spector. Best frickin' zombie anthology ever. And first zombie anthology ever. That, because it was so good, it made everyone else rise to write a better story for, about zombies. And you have some real literature in there, too. You have, you know, some stories that are landmark. And you have Stephen King, Dan Simmons, and David Chow, and so on. It's a great book. Third favorite zombie novel of all time. I am friends with everyone who writes zombie novels, so that could get me in some real trouble. I can't say Patient Zero, can I? Boy, it's hard to pick a favorite, because here's why it's hard to pick a favorite. They're not all telling the same type of story. They're so radically different, it's like trying to pick books from different genres. I mean, it would be easy to say World War Z, because it's the biggest selling zombie novel of all time. But I guess the one that I found the most fun to read was Dead City by Joe McKinney. I read that in one sitting. It was basically one long action scene. And Joe's a great writer. He's a San Antonio homicide cop. And he wrote a heck of a great zombie adventure. And it was nominated for a Stoker, too, for it. So if you haven't read Dead City, if you want a good zombie adventure where it's a whole lot of zombies and a real race against time, that's a damn good book. And I like all the others, too. I haven't read too many zombie books I don't like.
Movies?
Dawn of the Dead, of course. Night of the Living Dead, both versions. I like both versions. And if you haven't seen Night of the Living Dead Reanimated, I suggest you check it out, which they took the original film, kept the soundtrack, and animated over all the cells with, you know, a couple hundred different artists. It's fantastic. And I did the commentary track and had a blast with a couple of other great guys. Second favorite zombie film of all time is Shaun of the Dead. How could you not love Shaun of the Dead? I mean, it's a perfect zombie film. And it does the one thing with zombie comedy that you must do. You must respect the genre and the fans. And it respects the genre and the fans. When you insult the genre and the fans, either way, you lose everyone. So that was a great one. Of course, I like Zombieland, too. It's a fantastic comedy. Shaun of the Dead, I can watch almost all the time. And my third favorite zombie film is one that a lot of people haven't seen. The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, which just came out on DVD in America. It was a 1970s zombie film. Really good zombie horror film. Zombies are a little smarter than the Romero zombies. Creepy. They went with a great version of it on DVD. Crisp, unedited, because there's a lot of American versions that are edited. It's great. Absolutely worth catching.
Yeah, right there.
Yeah, you do. You think you do research on zombies and other stuff? There was a movie called Something in the Rainbow. Did you?
Yeah, it was based on a book by Dr. Wade Davis, an ethnobotanist, who went down to Haiti to figure out how the Haitian zombies work. And I interviewed him had a long phone conversation with Wade for Zombie CSU, because I wanted to establish that the zombies that we talk about in pop culture these days are not Haitian zombies. You know, most of the zombies we deal with have nothing to do with the Haitian zombie. And until the one I'm writing now, which combines both genres, scientifically. But he was very adamant about that Haitian zombies are not the George Romero flesh-eating ghouls. And Romero didn't call them zombies. The name got hung on the genre when Dawn of the Dead was distributed in Italy. And it came out as Zombie. Or Zombie 2, whatever it was. But they hung that name on it, and that name has never moved. So... But, you know, Wade, I usually go to anyone who has a connection to science, and if they have a connection to the topic as well as science, they usually love jumping in on this sort of stuff. And Wade called me, you know, he's a speaker for National Geo, and he called me, and he was more than happy to talk about it.
Yeah, right up here.
One of my favorite bits of Patient Zero was the science behind it and the prion disease, because I've never seen that take off. That before. How did you come to that idea?
When researching Zombie CSU. I talked to so many scientists around the world, you know, to find out what possible disease or combination of diseases, and in this case it's a combination of diseases and parasites, could possibly lead to an effective, aggressive, zombie-like state. And, you know, a lot of them said, you should start with something like fatal familial insomnia, which is a prion disease. It's a disease where once you get it, you can never fall asleep. You can't even be medicated to fall asleep. You're awake until your body from exhaustion and dies. Kind of horrible. So when something's that horrible and terrible, I've got to use it. So I started with that. And then I got guys to throw in ideas for parasites and other things that would keep them at certain parts of metabolism going and so on. But there is a point, though, you can take the science to a certain point, and then there's that one point where you stop having the scientists explain stuff in the book. Because you really, that's the point where things are falling down. But we got pretty damn close in patient zero. So close that a lot of scientists have said, wow, that's disturbing. I mean, and of course, that followed up with, cool. Because I know some guy out there in a lab is now trying to create cyafaldine probably.
Well, that's one of the things I've found fascinating to talk about with CSU and your other things, is that when you go to these people, generally they've already thought about the zombie angle to things.
Yep. Everyone I've talked to, cops, military, homeland security, scientists, every single one of them has at one point in their lives tried to figure out how they would deal with a zombie apocalypse. So I never really had to explain what a zombie apocalypse was, more like try to get them to slow down long enough for me to catch up with what they're saying. Because they're like, oh yeah, we figured this out. The SWAT guys from Bucks County ran scenarios for me on how they, and so did Joe McKinney down in San Antonio on fastest low zombies. The guys from Homeland had already, they ran the scenarios on your tax dollars. And now they have a protocol paper on how a counterterrorist team would reclaim the streets from zombies. And they gave me diagrams. Yes.
Well, I was going to ask you, just like that, wouldn't that work? That plan work well for any similar type actual virus?
Yes, and that's how they justified using the tax dollars. because really, the model that frightened people was 28 days later. That frightened the actual military and the CDC and World Health Organization, and they all built protocols. Some of them were even called the 28 days later protocol because of that. Because it's not entirely unreasonable, and there are, if you get the right, like there's a disease that causes ants to attack its own population. You get that and a couple other diseases mixed together, you're going to have 28 days later. You're going to have the rage virus. It's something that we could cook up now deliberately. It's just lucky that it's not probable that nature will do it anytime within the next 100 years. Not thousands, 100 years. So 100 years from now, your grandkids got to watch out.
One second. I think we should probably head to the reading portion of this so that we don't run out of time. And if we get done with that, then we'll come back for some more questions. But I don't think anyone want to miss this bit.
Yeah, and I'm also going to, when I'm done reading, I'm going to give away a couple of books. I'm giving away these three books. I'm going to have questions. Whoever answers the question right gets those three books. What I'm going to do is, this is the first time I've read this in public. It is the first two chapters, but it's pretty short, of Dead of Night, a zombie novel that would be published by St. Martin's Griffin in June of 2011. It is a standalone book, not attached to my other series. Chapter 1, this is how the world ends. Chapter 2. He was sure he was dying. It was how he imagined death would be. Cold. Darkness flowed slowly into the edges of everything, as if the shadows under tables and behind cabinets was leaking out into the room. Soft, not painful. That part was odd. In his dreams, and Lee Hartnett often dreamed of death, there was pain. Broken bones, bullet wounds, deep knife cuts. But this wasn't painful. Not anymore. Not after that first bite. There had been that one flash of pain, but even that was beautiful in its way, so intensely powerful that it possessed purity. It was beyond anything in his personal experience, though Lee had imagined it so many times. With the quiet people with whom he worked, the hollow people. The police and the EMTs brought him demonstrations of every kind of pain. Brutalized and beaten, crushed in car wrecks, suicides and murders. Even the cold ones, even the old ones from the nursing homes, the ones everyone believed died peacefully in their sleep, Lee knew that they had experienced pain too. For some, it was the rat-hungry gnawing of cancer. For others, it was the mind pain that came with having memories carved out of their brains by the ugly scalpel of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Pain for all. Pain was the coin that paid the ferryman. Even now, Lee smiled at that thought. It was something his father once said back in the days when Lee was the assistant and his father was the funeral director and mortician. Old John Hartnett had been a poetic man, humorless, but given to metaphor and simile. It was he who had started calling the bodies in their cold room the hollow men. Well, hollow people, to be PC. People from whom the sacred wind of life had fled through whatever crack the pain had chipped into them. And now Lee felt his own sacred wind trying to claw free. The wind, the breath, was the only heat left in him. A small, burning ball of dying air in his lungs that had nowhere to go. There wasn't enough left of his throat for Lee to exhale that breath. He would keep it. There would be no death rattle, which amused the professional in him. He knew that some other mortician would hear it when preparing his body. Then he thought better of it. No, it would not be a mortician. It would be a coroner. After all, he had been murdered. If you could call it murder. Lee watched the liquid darkness fill up the room. Was it murder? The man, his killer, could never be charged with murder, could he? If so, how? It was a puzzle. The cold intensified, and Lee wanted to cry out for warmth, but of course he could not do that, not with what was left of his throat. It was a shame. He was sure that he could manage at least one really good scream, like the ones in his dreams. Most of his dreams ended in a scream. That was usually what woke him up in the night. It's what finally drove his wife into leaving him. She could take the fact that he worked with the dead all day, and she was sympathetic to the fact that his work gave him nightmares. But after 8 years, she couldn't take the interruptions to her sleep 2 or 3 times a week. First it was earplugs, then separate rooms, and finally separate lives. He wondered what she would think about this. Not just his death, but his murder. He heard a noise and wanted to turn his head. Could not. The muscles in his neck were torn. Teeth and nails. He couldn't feel the wounds anymore. Even the coldness was fading. His body was a remote island separated from his mind by 1 million miles. The noise again, a clatter of metal, then the sing-song of tools dropped to the tiled floor. Retractors and needles and other items. Things he wouldn't need anymore. Things that would be used on him in just a few days. He wondered who would prepare his body for the box. Probably that schmuck Lester Savoy over in Bulltown. Another crash. Then a sound, like footsteps, but wrong somehow, awkward, disjointed, like a drunk trying to stagger across a barroom floor. Lee knew that this wasn't a drunk. He didn't have a name for what it was. Well, that was not exactly true. It was a hollow man. The room was darker now. Shadows were closing around him like a body bag being zipped up with him inside. A simile. Dad would have liked that. Lee felt his body shivering. He felt the vibration of it, but not the actual sensation. It was hard to understand. He knew that his flesh was trembling because his vision was shaking. But he felt no puckering of goosebumps on his flesh, no actual intensification of cold as he tried to retreat from it. And yet the vibration was there, the shaking. He wondered at it. It was so violent that for a moment he thought his body was going into convulsions. But that would have affected his eyesight, and he could still see as normally as the darkness allowed. His head lolled on his ruined throat, and he marveled that there was enough structural integrity left in his neck muscles to move his head so violently. Then all at once, Lee realized what was happening. It wasn't a wave of cold shivers. The cold, in fact, was nearly gone. It seemed to flee as the darkness grew. It wasn't convulsions either. In fact, the movement was not caused by any muscular action or nervous flutter anywhere in his body. That was purely external. He was being shaken. No, worried was the word. The way a terrier worries a rat. That was what was happening. And yet not a terrier. And this wasn't a hunting dog trying to break the neck of a rodent. No, this was something else. Even down here in the darkness, Lee realized how wrong it all was. He could not feel the teeth that clamped onto him. He was beyond the sensation of pressure and pain. All that was left to him was the savage movement of his body and the uncontrollable lolling of his head as the hollow man bit at him and tore him to pieces. The cold was gone now. The darkness closed over him, shutting out all light. Even the trembling vision faded into nothingness. Lee could feel himself die. He knew that he was dead. and that terrified him more than the man on the gurney, terrified him more than anything, more than when the man had opened his eyes, more than that first terrible bite, more than the cold and the darkness, more than the knowledge that he was being eaten. He knew that he was dead. He knew. How? God Almighty, how could he be dead and know? This was something he had never imagined, never dreamed. The wrongness of it howled in his head. He waited in the darkness for the nothingness to come, waited, prayed for it, screamed in a voiceless voice, but it did not come. Something else came instead.
Okay, we've got 10 minutes.
Now, in the subplot of this particular story is that the zombies who are created are aware that they're dead. And they are inside the zombies. They cannot affect in any way what the zombie does, so they're just a passenger watching as the zombies attack their family, their friends, and everything else. They're just there. And when I put with that idea, even I went, you know, it's a frightening thought. It's kind of how I imagine Alzheimer's might be. What if, as the ability to communicate with the world was diminished, but inside there was some part of the mind that knew that they were losing that connection. And Dead of Night deals with that, and also deals with, you know, the first zombie in the story is a serial killer who is executed at a Pennsylvania prison. The prison doctor is the one responsible for all this because he had tried to create a formula called Lucifer 113 that would keep the consciousness of the prisoner alive. He wanted the person to be in the coffin and suffer, to be aware of himself rotting as further punishment. The doctor's a little nuts. So he creates this pathogen, and, you know, with the belief that after the execution, by lethal injection, the prisoner would then be cremated. But a family member steps up to reclaim the body so it'd be buried in the family plot. And he wakes up. And the patient zero of that particular story, Homer Gibbon, the villain, is the only zombie who is both aware and in control of what he does. And he knows what he, once he realizes what he is and that he's decaying and that he's infectious, he decides to infect as many people as possible. He goes on a road trip. He is the Johnny Appleseed of the zombie apocalypse. And he's, you know, his whole thing is trying to break the containment, the quarantine set up around the town. And our cops are trying to stop him. And I did read the first line. First chapter, but this is the way the world ends. So it may not end well for the good guys, but of course there are lots of twists and curves around between that end of the book. Now, a couple things. One, I have a new book coming out September 14th, which is called Rotten Ruin. It's technically marketed as a young adult novel. It is, however, for everybody. And even Barnes & Noble is cross-marketing it for the adult. It's set 14 years after the zombie apocalypse, after the Night of the Living Dead, essentially. And a kid growing up in a little fenced-off community in Southern California, and everything else, the whole rest of the world, is the great rotten ruin. And he's apprenticing to his zombie hunter brother. And it is a book accessible for anyone. Even if you like hardcore zombies, there's plenty of those. But there's also a good story about, you know, coming of age and learning the value of life. And some pretty cool kenjutsu for those who like swordplay. My weapon of choice for zombies. Now, I do have some books to give away, so I'm going to have a zombie quiz. And maybe a Joe Ledger quiz. How many here are zombie fans? That's right. Okay. Most of you. Good. Does anyone know the original working title of Night of the Living Dead? Show of hands. Don't fall out. Night of the Living Dead was the third choice. I'll take either of the two earlier choices. And I'll give you a hint. The first two words are Night of. What's that?
Night of the Walking Dead.
Good guess, but no.
Night of the Ghouls.
Nope. Also a good guess.
Night of the Slightly Alive.
Yeah, that was nope. Last night here at Dragon.
Okay. So, yeah.
Was it
one
Night of the Beings?
No.
Night of the Beings.
Nope. That was Night of the Comet. It was a film much later. Okay. No, really? My own people? Not.
It's in Zombie CSU.
It's,
yeah.
Yeah. Nobody? Okay, I'll give you Night of Anubis was the first title, and Night of the Flesh Eaters was the second title.
Yeah.
We'll move on. Does anyone... There is an... All right. Zombie CSU won an award that is named after the actor who played the very first zombie in Night of the Living Dead. Does anyone know the name of that zombie? Bill...
Hinsman.
All right, great. You get to pick which book you want.
Yay. Zombie CSU, because that's all right. The one I don't have.
Okay.
Good choice.
Good choice. Nice. Actually, you know what? I think I'll hold on to this, and I'll do the signing right after.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Walking Dead is an AMC TV series based on a comic by Robert Kirkman. From which comic company?
Image.
Okay. Good. Good. You know, last night nobody knew the answer. Pick which one you like. This anthology has the short story that this is based on.
So I take it the Marvel Zombies isn't in the deal here?
actually, that's my only copy of
Marvel. Okay.
Living Dead, which is not actually officially out yet, has a short story sequel to Patient Zero. And then you have Patient Zero. So what would your choice be?
Let's see. New Dead here.
Okay, take cool. It. And I'll sign it after.
Thanks.
Cool. All right, we're down to two books. And by the way, for those who read Patient Zero, there is a short story that's a direct sequel to the zombie story in Patient Zero. It is the only other Joe Ledger zombie story planned. So for those, and it's a great collection of short stories. It'll be out later this month. A couple stores have it now. Okay. Zombie questions. I hit with a couple what I thought were good ones, but all right, tell you what. So hit me with a zombie question. If you stump me, you get the book.
Oh, all right.
It has to be a zombie, but it has to be directly zombie.
Zombie movie, zombie pop culture. I'm giving you a lot of latitude. I'm trying to give these books away, you see. So.
What's the name of the virus from World War Z?
Solanum.
What is the West Congo word from which zombie is believed to have been derived?
There are a couple. Zvembi is one. Sumbi is another one. And there's also a name for a snake god of that era, of that location. That is also, and that is, it's in One Undead or Alive too, and it's in Dust and Decay. But Zvembi is the one that I know is from the West Congo.
One, it was Zambi,
Z-A-M-B-I,
I think it's the
same. Well, that's close enough.
That's close enough.
You get to choose a book.
Oh, do I? Well, I already have Patient Zero. So
let me get two. All right, cool. Another, all right, that's what you're going to go.
What is your third favorite zombie?
Damn. You're recording this, right? The one that I read, I'll go with ones that I had to read cover to cover without stopping. Breeders, S.G. Brown. I read that cover to cover, couldn't put it down. So I would go with that. But I've got a bunch of other people that if they see this video are going to send me emails. You got me in trouble. Yeah.
What's the name of the virus in Mira Grant's feet?
Mira Grant's feet. That's the name of the trilogy. Ooh, that's... I don't remember.
Yes.
What is it?
Tell us Amberly.
Oh, damn it, yes. All right, you get yes. Patient Zero. And I'll sign that after. Okay.
I think we got a couple minutes.
Any last questions about anything? Yeah, right there.
I just want to put a plug in for Rotten Ruin, because I've read the novella that's in the anthology, and it was emotional, it was original. I hadn't seen quite that take on it.
It was beyond original. It was surprising.
Yeah, that was a great, great story, so I'm really excited about that.
Oh, thanks. It was a lot of fun to write that, and I just finished the sequel, Dust and Decay, and I had so much fun writing it. But it was also, a lot of the stuff that makes up the originality of that story has been cooking in my brain since I was a kid. And it was partly because I'm a science geek. You know, like, when I see the way people fight zombies in movies, if it's first, like a first night sort of thing where zombies are just in your face, yeah, I can understand panic and so on. But if you've been fighting them for more than a day and you have a rational mind, there are a lot of ways you can defeat them. They're not outthinking you. You can outthink them. Like this room, we could defend this room against any number of zombies. You think they're really going to crawl over all these chairs? And you don't think we can block that door? There's so many things. We've got weapons. We can break everything down. We can tear up the carpet and wrap ourselves in carpet because you can't bite through carpet. And carpet coats is one of the industries that grows up in the post-apocalyptic world. There are ways to survive. It takes somebody with a kind of like a MacGyver sort of thing. And for me, in jiu-jitsu, we have something called Hidaka Kadosu, which means the art of the naked kill. It's a science, sub-science, where we learn how to use anything as a weapon. And as a result, you know, you pick up anything, you can see its combat value to it. There's actually, and believe it or not, in mime, a similar thing called shapography, where they give you a felt hat, and you turn the hat into all sorts of things. It's all about seeing the other possible things that any object can be. And it helps you, you know, create an inventive response to almost any situation. So, yeah, there's a lot of fun stuff in that.
Okay. All right, well, I think we are out of time. Everyone, Jonathan Mayberry.